Entree Architect Podcast, Build Your Brand Podcast, ArcaSpeak Podcast, Spaces Podcast, and now Practice Disrupted and Troxel. All your favorite podcasts in one place. GableMedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com. Go listen and subscribe right now. My name is Mark Arlepage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. This is episode 330, Using Instagram to Grow Beyond Your Small Town Roots, with Rafe Churchill of Bullfinch Award winner Hendrix Churchill. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, ARCAD, the online resource delivering quality building material information, CAD details, BIM specifications, and so much more for free at ARCAD.com, and Gusto, easy online payroll, benefits, and HR built for modern small businesses like ours. Rafe Churchill, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having me. I've heard a few of your episodes. I was very excited about the opportunity.
Yeah, this will be fun. I think this is a topic that many of our listeners will find interesting. But before we get into the conversation, let me just let people know who you are. Rafe Churchill is the co-founder and creative director of Hendrix Churchill, an architecture and interior design firm based in Sharon, Connecticut. A third-generation carpenter, Rafe grew up developing his craft as a builder and artist, and he eventually realized his passion was combining his study of architecture with both building and art. And in 2017, Rafe merged his practice with his wife, Heidi Hendricks' interior design practice, to form their firm, Hendricks Churchill. So, Rafe, I shared a little bit about you, a little tidbit. I'd love to dive a little bit deeper into your story. So go back as far as you would like to. And tell us where you discovered architecture, what inspired you to become an architect, and share that story to where we are today.
Sure, thanks. Well, as you mentioned, I was born a third generation carpenter or builder. I grew up surrounded by carpenters and tradespeople. My grandfather, my uncle, my father, their cousins, everyone in the family was in construction. Thanksgiving dinner, we talked about construction.
Yeah.
So that's everything that I knew growing up. But as you know, as a kid and as a teen, there was art in my life. So I knew that there was something else brewing slowly. I ended up going to school for art and architecture. I was a sculpture major in college, and I studied sculpture and architecture as a double major. After college, I went to grad school for architecture and sculpture. But the difference is that I worked construction all the way through. After school, I moved to New York and did the struggling artist thing. But the way I made my money was as a designer. So working in galleries and lofts in New York, eventually left the city with my wife, Heidi. We've been together almost 25 years. I came back out to the country and did a little work in the family business and ran a construction company for a number of years with my brother and my father. My brother and I eventually ran the company on our own, and we had at times 28 employees. So it was very successful, but there was still something missing, right? So I had done a number of years in architecture. I studied architecture, and my wife and I had bought a few properties over these years, bought them, fixed them up, sold them, or bought them and rented them out. In fact, our first house, I think, cost $30,000. So we renovated that, flipped it, made some money, and just kept buying up. What happened is people kind of caught on and saw what we were doing, and we were approached. So people came to us and said, hey, I heard about this house that you did, and maybe I was even, we probably lived there. And so they came over to check it out, and they said, hey, you know what? Not only do I want you to build it, but I'd like you to be the designer. So, I welcomed that opportunity because the first house I ever designed was when I was 16 years old. My father was a builder, and he had a client who wanted this house, and they came to us with these ideas, and my father pretty much put this on my lap and said, "So yeah, you're going to do this," and we're talking pencil, paper.
Yeah,
I was taking drafting in high school.
Yeah, you're the designer in the family. Go to work.
Yeah, right. So he's like, do it. And so I worked with the owner. I worked with him. Keep in mind, I was 16. So, I was doing what I was told.
Right. Yeah.
Most of the time. So I do remember a moment when, I actually had the benefit of working on that house as a laborer and a helper. And then I painted the place, the exterior. So I had this moment where I stood back on the hill and looked at the house, and it occurred to me, I was like, oh my God, it looks exactly like the drawing.
Yeah. I think a lot of architects have that moment where they see something for the first time that they designed, that they've been living with in their head for all those months and years, that they finally see it. And there's sort of this impact that it has on them.
Yeah, well, as a kid, as a 16-year-old, it kind of says to you, you asked for it,
yeah,
and there it is. I hope you like it.
Yeah.
Because, one of the things that I tell people in the office is, like, we're putting lines on paper. Yes, it's in AutoCAD and it feels like it's not real, but you have a responsibility to the people in the field and to your client, and most importantly to the project. You're putting lines on paper, and every line represents something. So be absolutely certain that that's what you intend. A mistake is a mistake, but like any note, any written description, any renderings that you provide, that's what people are expecting to see. So for a 16-year-old kid, I naively was impressed with what was happening because it looked exactly like the drawing. So eventually, back to adulthood, I took on those opportunities. And I had a few smaller projects, and then some large projects came in where I was working with the family business, where they happened to be the builder. So that worked out well, because as a young designer or architect, everybody has stories about, maybe they were, faking it until they made it, or, jumped in the deep end maybe a little too soon.
Yeah.
I was very much in the deep end. We're talking 10,000 square foot houses, timber frame from Canada. We'd go up to Canada, measure, video, shoot photos, come back, draw this thing, pour a foundation, and then the flatbed truck would show up with a timber frame strapped down to the deck and labeled. Yeah. And then our team would assemble it. And everyone's just like, oh man, I hope the kid got it right.
Did you know how deep you are back then? Did you know that you were in the deep end? Or is that looking back in hindsight?
You know what? It's when you grow up with it and you see your father and everybody else living it, you think it's normal.
That's just the way it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
I also wanted to ask you one other question about growing up in a contractor builder family. Are you the only architect? Or the first architect? Was there any pushback from your family when you decided that you wanted to be an architect?
No, not at all. If anything, it was more like, well, good. Maybe you can, make a difference. Because, it's like the builder architect
dynamic. That's why I ask that question.
And the family I came from, my grandfather drove around in a pickup truck with tools in the back. He was not, a high-end builder.
Yeah.
Highly skilled, but truly old school carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
So for my family to find out that I was going to school for architecture, they liked the idea that one of them may be contributing to solving the problem or something.
Yeah, yeah. Because I have a similar story. I don't come from a whole generations of contractors, but my father was an auto mechanic. My uncle was a contractor, And when I told him that I was going to be an architect, he said, "Why?" You know, and for similar reasons, because of that conflict. And I worked early on growing up, having that influence from my uncle. I very specifically worked in the field in order to discover, to try to learn why that dynamic existed. So when I became an architect, I could, you know, relate better with the contractors that I was working with.
Right.
And so I thought it was interesting to sort of get your take on that dynamic of contractors and architects.
Yeah, well, that dynamic still exists in my life. and I go pretty much from one side to the other, right?
So yeah.
My brother's a builder, you know, we have good laughs at times because, you know, we exchange stories about our experiences on site or, you know, with clients or with people that we work with. That dynamic's not going away, right? It's just the architect turns over a set of drawings. The builder's responsible to pay for it, to build it, and often they're responsible to honor a number, a price.
Right.
That inherently just like sets the tone, right?
Yeah.
So it's tricky, but I do remember the moment when I had kind of crossed over from builder to architect, where I was like, wow, it is very different on this side of the fence.
Yeah, yeah.
Just a very different relationship with the clients.
Yeah, very much.
For sure.
Very much.
For sure.
And there's an air-conditioned office that you work in the summertime.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Like, I didn't really enjoy working construction. I did it for a while. I was good at it. I thrived in that environment, and I was good at running a construction company and getting the work. But I didn't find it all that satisfying. And to be honest, it's, you know, it's difficult work. It's physically demanding. And given the years that I worked in construction, it was, you know, it was kind of brutal at times, physically.
Yeah.
And I still wear that, you know, like today I still have, you know, I mean, if you were to meet me, you know, you'd wonder, is that guy an architect or a contractor? You know, I'm kind of oversized in a sense. I'm 6'5". I'm very physical. And when I walk on a job site, the contractors are kind of just like, who's this guy? That's the architect.
Right. Can't figure it out. Right. But that, does that help you with that dynamic when you come onto the site with the experience and the knowledge that comes with it, but also your appearance and the way that you present yourself?
Yeah, it definitely does. Because the first thing is I discourage that kind of client architect versus builder sort of approach. It's very important to me that it be as equal as possible. Mm-hmm. I try to take the role, like I very much see myself as like the middleman between the two. And I try to explain to both the clients and the builder, this is how we're going to work together. This is how the process is going to go. No, we're not going to do that because that's not fair. That's not right. Mm-hmm. And I think your expectations might be unrealistic. And I could be saying that to either person. You know, there's no assumptions to be made about who I'm talking to. Both sides have been guilty about looking out for themselves. That doesn't help anybody, right? Because ultimately, aren't we there for the project? Like that's why we're there. When we're finished, when we walk away, it's all about the house.
Right. Right.
I think a lot of people fall into the trap of making it all about the client or making it all about the architect. And then of course, some builders might try to make it all about the builder. That's not going to be successful. I think that, you know, we have to work for the project first. Mm-hmm. We all work for our firm, right? We all have to maintain our firm and make sure it's sustainable. But when it comes to the project and that dynamic, it's all about the project, and you have to manage every member of the team to make sure that that's the common goal.
So you worked, you started your firm, you started doing these projects, you started flipping these houses that the clients mm-hmm. would come to you. When did you sort of decide, okay, this is going to be what I do, that I'm going to go to the architecture side and open a firm?
Pretty much when these prospective clients told me that's what I was going to do. It became really quite obvious. At that time, there was only, I think I had a small office of like three people. So I left the construction business, literally, like, you know, I still today, I'm not comfortable with how we had to split up. But I said to my brother, like, look, this is a good time. We've got some money in the bank. We just finished up some big projects. It's time. I'm stepping aside. Mm-hmm. I'm out. I had a couple of guys with me on staff who were doing design work. I took them with me and we started a new firm and the work just came in. But, you know, if you only have two or three people, you don't need a lot of work.
Right.
You need a couple projects at a time. So that worked well. Word of mouth is the best way to get work. So for a tiny little firm like that, it was totally sustainable. We just kept going.
Right. And when did you partner with your wife? How did that happen?
That happened 3 years ago. So my wife had her own interior design firm for several years, which in part was the result of these clients of mine coming to our house for a dinner. Mm-hmm. And they looked around and said, well, we love everything that's going on in here. Why don't you do this for us?
Yeah.
And, you know, you've heard that story 100 times where somebody saw something they liked and then sought out that person and that person became something they didn't see themselves becoming. That's pretty much what happened with Heidi. And the same thing, very small firm, you know, two people, and it just kept snowballing and it was growing and growing. And our clients just kept putting us together, right? Like, and I would say even to this day, even though we are partners, people that call us for projects in architecture often assume that Heidi will be joining the team. Those same assumptions were made 5 years ago. So I would get a call from somebody living in New York who wanted a country house out in, say, the Hudson Valley somewhere. They just assumed that Heidi would be joining the team. They didn't even consider the possibility that we didn't work together.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you just sort of decided that it made sense to merge and start
it did.
A new firm?
Yeah. Eventually it became kind of obvious, right? Like why run two sets of books, two businesses, two sets of employees that when in fact it all overlaps so easily anyway. So we merged and formed the new firm.
Were you ever tempted to go design build with your construction background?
I was.
What was the decision for not doing that?
Well, I decided not to do it. For one, I find construction very challenging. It's stressful. It's often contentious, and it's all about money. Right, like I'm making broad assumptions that the quality is happening, we're sticking to the schedule, but it's so much of it's about money, and that's true in architecture too, but it's easier in architecture I think to manage with broader strokes. When you're in construction, you have to you're responsible for every penny.
Yeah, it's very different. Strokes, very different business. Yeah.
The strokes are not so broad. In addition, our goals for the design firm quickly changed from enjoying this opportunity to do these very specific and small projects to an increased interest where it became apparent that we may have a shot at doing some really decent work, some strong work. And I found that being a design build firm could discourage a higher level client mm-hmm. from approaching us.
Yeah, that's interesting. This episode is supported by our platform sponsors, Arcat and Gusto. You know, it might be a while before we start attending trade shows again. So what's your plan? What's your plan to stay up to date with new building products and building materials, information, all of that stuff that you find when you go to your expo? Arcat works with leading manufacturers to showcase their products and host their technical data. You can see what's new from your favorite manufacturers, or find a product that you didn't even know you needed, just like you do when you walk the floor at your favorite expo. Looking for a way to keep up with your continuing education requirements? Did you know that Arcat works with manufacturers to list their latest continuing education courses so that you can get those credits while you stay at home? And best of all, like everything Arcat does, it's free. No payment, no subscriptions, no registration. You don't even need to give them your email. It's all there waiting for you for free. Use Arcat to keep up with the latest and greatest architectural products and let them know that we sent you so they know that you're a member of the Entree Architect community. Visit Arcat today at arcat.com. That's ARCAT.com. Arcat.com. I know what it's like to be an entrepreneur architect because I'm a small firm architect too. I know what it's like to wear all those hats. And some of those hats are great, but some, like filing taxes and running payroll, not so great. That's where our friends at Gusto come in. Gusto makes payroll, taxes, and HR actually easy for small businesses like ours. Fast, simple payroll processing, benefits, and simple management tools all in one place. Gusto automatically pays and files your taxes so you don't have to worry about it. And when you're ready to add on health benefits or a 401k for your team, they can do that too. Easy, no stress. Those old school clunky payroll providers just weren't built for the way modern small businesses work, but Gusto is. So let them wear one of your many hats. You have better things to do, like being an architect. Members of the Entree Architect community receive 3 months free when you run your first payroll. Try a demo today and see for yourself at gusto.com/architect. That's gusto.com/architect. Arcat and Gusto. Please visit our platform sponsors today. Let them know that Entree Architect sent you and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. So your firm today is about 10 or 11 people, right?
That's right, yeah.
And you're in Sharon, Connecticut. I know Sharon, Connecticut well because I used to live in Westchester, New York. It's a small town. And so what are some of the challenges of working as an architect in a small town?
So Sharon's about 2,500 people. It's about 2.5 hours from New York City. Living and working in a small town can be challenging. It's hard to find people when your office is based in Manhattan. Imagine finding people. Look, you can put an ad out and you can get 50 applicants, right? If you're in New York, you're going to get 50 applicants for sure. If you're in Sharon, Connecticut, you might get 15 or 20. It's difficult to say how many of those are real applicants.
Right.
But the hard part is attracting the right people. So for several years, I found it very, very challenging. You need to make a very focused attempt at where you're looking and who you're looking for. But I have found in the last couple of years that our best candidates approached us. They were not responding to an advertisement.
And how did that happen? What were they responding to? How were you getting the word out of who you were and what you did in order for them to be attracted to you?
Well, I think a lot more people are aware of what we do through Instagram, for one. And our primary goal after finding good, talented people is finding people that have the right energy and the right interests. And we want if you have 11 people, you want to have a good mix of people, right? You want to have senior members who have experience. You want to have young people who are going to bring a certain energy to the studio. And I think through Instagram, we have probably grown some roots that we weren't aware were available. We recently relocated two families from New York City, a young woman from Detroit, and a guy from Miami. So these people just all approached us.
And they all found you through Instagram?
For the most part, yeah.
Yeah. So was there, when you started using social media, specifically Instagram, was there a strategy from the beginning, or did you just start sort of showing your work and then recognize that there was an opportunity before you sort of strategically started using it?
Well, I would say that, you know, anyone that uses Instagram and works full time knows that it's really not that much fun, right? it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
So initially, we were encouraged by a couple of friends, you know, maybe a few years ago, saying, look, you have to use this. You have to use this. And so we would just start throwing up some photos, started off with more personal stuff, and then slowly leaked into work, you know, projects, site visits, professional photos, interiors. And it just kind of snowballed. Last year we had several thousand followers, and now we're over 11,000. There's a point when it seems to just start to, you know, feed itself. Like, you know, we're picking up 5 or 10 new followers a day now. I couldn't tell you why, but what I can tell you is that when we are active on Instagram, that's a good thing, because we're actually reaching people. If we get too busy and we don't pay attention, it kind of sits, you know, quiet for a little while.
Right. Do you have a specific strategy for Instagram, or is it just when you have time, you add, you know, add photos to it?
I wish I could tell you that we had a strategy. We're working toward that, because we're realizing that you know, for this to be sustainable out in the country, you really have to be on it, right? You have to pay attention. The primary goal is, like, let's just get these images up, right? Let's show people what we're doing. Once in a while, you might see something behind the scenes. You might see a site visit, but it's pretty much we're not disclosing a whole lot of information about the office. It's just more about the projects.
Right. Right.
But it's, you know, it's funny what people see, though. Because I have people come to us and they're speaking about our projects very specifically. And I take it for granted. Like, I really think nothing of the fact that we often do this or often do that, because that just comes naturally. I think people see what they need to see. And they're looking at thousands of photos a day. And if something jumps out, they figure out on their own why, and they find the connection.
Yeah, yeah. And just to clarify, and it may be obvious in our conversations, but you do high-end residential work, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, just because exactly. We didn't mention that, and there might be listeners
who
are
thinking.
Yeah,
that's true, yeah.
Yeah, so the work that you're showing is high-end residential, and they're beautiful photographs, so they're not just snapshots, they're professional photography, mostly. And so it's a very specific feed that you're looking at when you follow that Instagram channel.
Right. That's true. Now, we definitely put an effort into photography. You know, when running a business, that's a line item in your overhead, right? It's part of the marketing. You have to invest. You can't avoid self-promotion. You know, the one thing I learned years ago in my early 20s, when I was an artist in New York, was you're not going to make it without self-promotion. And as a 22-year-old, that wasn't going to happen for me. I wasn't there yet.
Yeah.
But you know, in my 30s, you have a couple of kids and a mortgage, and you wake up one day and you're like, okay, you have to get over this. You have to tell people who you are, what you do, and that you do it well.
Yeah.
You can't be afraid to tell them that you do it well.
Yeah. And being in Sharon in a small town, it's complicated. And so having these tools to be able to reach out to the world and show the world what you do not only brings in quality employees, but probably brings in some projects. Are there other things that you're doing to be able to practice successfully at a small town? Because I get that question all the time from small town architects who are struggling and they just don't know how to get the work and how to get the quality employees. Are there specific suggestions that you can make to those architects on how to do what you're doing?
As far as getting the work, I think it requires a willingness to travel, right? You certainly don't want to limit yourself to, say, a 45-minute radius. We have a project in Austin, Texas. We have one in Falmouth, Maine. We have projects in Connecticut and New York State that are all within 3 hours. It's rare for us to have a project half an hour, even in Sharon, for that matter. We're willing to travel for the work. And anybody who's had any experience with that knows that at first it can seem like a daunting responsibility, right, to do this. But the truth is, if it's well managed and you schedule your site visits and you hire the right builder, then it goes pretty smoothly. But there has to be a willingness to work beyond your comfort zone, right? And most people are very comfortable within 45 minutes of their office. And as far as staffing, I honestly, we're still trying to figure out how we attracted such a good team.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, there's 11 of us, and I honestly can't imagine any of them leaving. I mean, it's a very solid group. And they range from 21 years, up. So that's great. You want a good mix, but still youthful firm.
Yeah.
Because you want there to be a future.
It was interesting what you had said before when you said that those people were being attracted through Instagram and that you were willing to relocate them. And so I think often what happens is that architects sort of look within that immediate geographic range, and that's it. That's sort of, they look at their pool of people there rather than looking at the entire world as an opportunity for bringing people into your firm and finding the best of the best and sort of presenting yourself as a firm like you do on Instagram, attract the lots of people to you, and then you can pick out the people who you feel best, who are most qualified and have the best, sort of character and the way that you relate with them, the personalities that these people have. All of that lends to the culture that you've built at your firm, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, one of the things that we've worked towards, and I've worked at other firms, and my favorite thing to do is to talk to people while they're still working at another firm. And you hear the stories about how, and I don't want to offend anybody when I say this, but like you hear stories about how nobody's talking, everybody has earbuds on.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to talk to the principal or a lead designer or anybody without an appointment, or maybe at the end of the day or next Tuesday. And the culture is just awful. People just sit at a desk for 8 to 10 hours a day, miserable, stuck on interior elevations of a powder room. And in our firm, we're always walking through the office, right? So we're in an old house in the center of Sharon, right on the green. So it's not like a big, beautiful open space. It's several different rooms, right? There were probably bedrooms, dining room, things like that at one time. So we have, say, 2 to 4 people in a room. And we'll spend our time walking through the building all day, stopping and talking to people, going over things. And then we'll have team meetings where we sit down at the conference table and review drawings. But I think the best way is to make yourself available. And don't make it about you, because as soon as you start making it about you, you're gonna lose track of the firm and the people that make up your team. The stories I hear from other offices are just—they're not healthy, right? It's not a healthy work environment. I've heard stories from clients where they're crying on the ride home after a design meeting with their architect. Like, that should never happen.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you shouldn't make people feel bad because you're prioritizing the design or what you consider to be the most important part of the project. So, some people might say that we have like a lateral hierarchy or a flat organization. There's definitely a structure in place, but every voice is heard, and somebody may be helping out with marketing one day, but then doing a deep dive on interiors or working on specifications for 4 or 5 days. We try to jump around.
Yeah. Earlier in our conversation, you had mentioned that one of the keys to success out in the field is to put the project first. And it's not about the architect. It's not about the contractor. It's not even about the owner. It's about the project and coming together. Do you, and it sounds like you do, it sounds like with your firm that it's not about you. It's not about Heidi. It's not about even the team. It's about the firm. Is that sort of how your culture is built, that it's really firm first?
That's our goal. Yeah. I mean, look, it's hard to maintain that because there are days when everybody looks at you to solve problems or fix something, or like even now, everyone just wants to know, like, how are we doing? Are we, do we have work 3 months out? Do we have work 6 months out? And you have to be careful because you can get sucked into that, right? You can, answering all those questions, putting out all those fires. So there are days where you catch yourself, but generally, if you're going to make changes in the office, whether it's with software or project management and even marketing, you want to talk to the team and get a sense of where their interests fall, what their experience is, and how they can actually contribute. Because there's a very good chance that somebody in the office has a better understanding of what you're trying to accomplish. And I think if you try to solve these problems on your own, you'll fall short and you might make a fool of yourself while doing it. That's the real benefit of having a diverse group of people.
Yeah.
Is that you're going to get different answers.
Yeah. And the maturity of the leader to be able to recognize that there are other voices and there are valuable opinions coming from those voices and being able to accept them, I think, is really an important piece of the puzzle in terms of the leaders of that firm.
Yeah. That takes a little while.
Yeah, it does. It's hard to do. Yeah. But when you do and you get that feedback and you recognize that that's a very important way of being a quality leader, and you see the results of that, it gets easier because you get the results of of getting that information. Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you. You hinted at it a little bit, but we're recording this mid-April 2020. We're about a month into the whole coronavirus crisis, quote unquote. How is your firm doing, and are you doing some specific things to sort of plan for the future as we move forward on this?
That's a good question. So we're entering our fifth week of working remotely. Pretty much all the construction projects have closed, have shut down, which is good because that's the only safe way to move forward. So we've got 11 people working remotely. That happened overnight. We literally sat down on a Monday morning 4.5 weeks ago or something and started to talk about it. And about 10 minutes into it, it was like, okay, so obviously we're going to start working remotely tonight.
Right.
So it was a bit of a scramble. The first week was really challenging. If you talk to the individual team members, which of course I did, they all thought it was fine and it was going really, really well. But that's because you've got, 9 people working on 1 or 2 projects, right? I was working like 16 hours a day, just trying. Right. Now you're setting up these Zoom calls. These calls go from anywhere from 15 minutes to 2 hours. And come 5:30, everybody else stopped working. But I was like, oh, good. Now I can start working.
Yeah.
So I found that first week really challenging. The second week was a little easier. Now we're entering our fifth week, and it feels pretty good. Now we're starting to make a real effort to communicate more just socially, mm-hmm. and not just about the work. So Heidi's talking to everybody about, like, each person every day contributes an update about, you know, basically the stuff that they would be talking about if we were sitting 5 feet away from them.
Yeah.
You know, what's going on in your life? What'd you watch last night? What are you reading? What are you thinking about? That's important.
Yeah.
Because otherwise we're just like machines, just plugged in.
Right. And the culture that you built depended on the building that you were in, right? That old building and the way that people can communicate and the spontaneity that comes with being in a building like that. When you move to remote places and everybody's working on their own, that happenstance and that spontaneity needs to turn into a process, right? In order for that to happen, in order for the culture to not disintegrate, that culture that was so important when you're all together, pieces of that make that culture the culture that it is, needs to become more intentional.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you have to be careful, because if you're trying to manage these two or three teams of people and you literally just want to get through your list, you could just start burning through people.
Right.
And pushing and not listening.
Yeah.
And I'd like to think that we caught ourselves before that started to happen.
Yeah.
But I could definitely see people burning out if they don't feel like they're part of something again.
Yeah. Yeah. We had spoken to a consultant named Jane Walton on earlier episodes, and she specifically talked about the first thing that you need to do is build those relationships with your team and put in the systems to be able to allow them to be heard and for you to be able to hear them, because those things don't happen automatically when you're on a Zoom call. Those things need to be put in place so they know when and where and how those communications will happen, which will allow them to not only be heard from a business point of view, but from a social point of view.
Right, for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, it's important for people to grow during this time. We're not just going to sit here and wait.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, we have people, it's only been a few weeks, 4 weeks, but I've seen progress being made because some of these individuals are being asked to step up. Right.
Right.
They're not sitting next to their senior person anymore. So they actually have to take on some additional responsibility.
Yeah.
And they can't just turn their head and ask a quick question. They actually now have to decide, do I really want to ask that question or can I just make this happen?
Yeah, that's very interesting. Very interesting. Rafe, this has been a really interesting conversation. Before we wrap up, I want to ask you the one question that I ask everybody here at the podcast. What is one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Well, we talked about that a little bit. I would say that what we're realizing is the most important thing is finding the right people to join the team. And it's not a short-term plan. We're talking long-term plan. So I recently turned 50 years old, and I'm realizing, you know, okay, like, I'd like to think that's young, but let's realize we got to get some people in place, because this is a good, strong thing we have going. And it shouldn't end. It doesn't have to end. And if everybody's a player, then things won't change, right? If I'm less involved someday, things won't change. So if you want to build a firm that's sustainable and maybe will outlive you, it's all about the people.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to invest.
Excellent advice. His name is Rafe Churchill. The firm's name is Hendrix Churchill. You can find out more information about Rafe and the firm at hendrixchurchill.com. We'll have a link on our show notes. Definitely check out his Instagram, the firm's Instagram. I think it's Hendrix Churchill. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Yep. We'll have links to all of that on the show notes. Rafe, this has been a really interesting conversation. Thank you for coming by and spending some time with us and sharing your knowledge here at Entree Architect Podcast.
You bet. Thanks, Mark.
You've been listening to episode 330. The link to the show notes and the link to share with a friend. Please, one friend, that's all. It's simple, simple, simple ask here. EntreeArchitect.com/episode330. That's EntreeArchitect.com/episode330. 330. Type that up right now into your Facebook, into your Twitter, into Instagram. You put a little Instagram graphic, say, hey, I listen to Entree Architect Podcast. Listen to episode 330. You could do that too. You could send it in an email. You could tap your friend on the shoulder. Well, actually, you can't tap your friend on the shoulder. Your friend's not there. So email it to him. Email him or her this link, entrearchitect.com/episode330. If you like this podcast, you are going to love our new multimedia network, Gable Media. All your favorite architecture podcasts, all in one place. They're all there. Listen and subscribe right now at GableMedia.com. That's GABLMedia.com. Be well, my friends. Be healthy, be happy, safe, and secure. Thanks for listening today. Now more than ever, love, learn, and share what you know.